I'm Jared Rall. I'm the director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists.
And tell me why you are going to Australia and when.
I actually have a house here, have a home here, and I came in from the US in through Hong Kong and into Australia at the beginning of the pandemic. And with the pandemic, it seemed logical to stay here for a few months. I'm an Australian citizen, so when the pandemic happened, I was not able to travel because one of the things they did here is actually restrict you traveling internationally. So you had to get a special visa to leave the country. But we have a project. We had a project coming out, a major international project. I needed to get back to DC, so I applied for the visa. I got the visa, got an exemption, a business exemption to leave the country, and then I traveled to DC and then on to Europe and then back into Australia.
So when were you trying to come back into Australia?
About 5 weeks ago, whenever that is. And then of course there was 2 weeks of mandatory quarantine when you land back in the country. I'd been gone about 2.5 months at that point.
Okay, so tell me what that was like. I mean, you landed on the tarmac, and were you able to go home? Were you able to do anything else, or did you immediately quarantine, and where did you quarantine?
You are escorted from the plane. They have to go through some basic medical tests, medical questions. You then leave the airport, but there's no other, place everywhere, so there's nowhere else to go. You're escorted onto a bus. There's about three, I think if I recall, there were three buses lined up outside the terminal, and you are randomly assorted to a bus. The bus driver, of course, we asked the bus driver where we were going, which hotel, and they were told they didn't know that we were going to get a police escort to the hotel. So eventually, after about 30 or 40 minutes after we had enough people on the bus took off with a police escort, and we were brought into the central of the city, center of the city, into a hotel, where again we were processed in and escorted by a policeman, and or actually it was an army person, to a hotel room, and you are literally put in that hotel room, and the door closes, and that's it for 2 weeks. You don't see any human being.
So what were those 2 weeks like? I mean, how did you get food? Were you able to leave that room at all? Did you see anyone else?
No, you don't see anybody else. You're not allowed to leave the room. But I was lucky. It was a comfortable room. I had nothing to complain about there. The only complaint I would have, if I had any complaint, was that there was no air in the room. You couldn't open a window, so there was no balcony. You couldn't get sunshine. But otherwise, it was perfectly comfortable. It was a nice 5-star hotel in the center of city, and 3 times a day there'd be a knock on the door, and food would be left outside the door, and you would open the door, collect the food, and that was it.
What was that like, though, to not have any fresh air for 2 weeks? I mean, to not like be able to go take a walk or even just open the window.
It was tough after the first few days. The first few days you don't really mind because it's a long journey home and you tend to sleep and have a lot of jet lag, so it's easy. But you get into a routine, and also you're prepared for it because I knew it was going to happen. It wasn't like it was a shock. It wasn't like you were being sent to prison, and you had very good internet, so you could still talk to people on the phone. I mean, for me, it was just like continuation of work. After the first day, I think there was a complaint by one of the other guests that I was making phone calls at 3 in the morning because I work internationally. So I had to stop doing that. That was a little annoying. But then you just get into a routine. You get to look at, you look out the window and you see other guests, and they put little stickers up on their windows. When there was a big horse race here, they would have horse stickers up. When the US election was taking place during this period, so they had, Biden, stickers on the window. They're clearly Biden supporters, and so you sort of communicated. It was almost like with hand signals and with little, there was a poppy day here, which we got poppies for Remembrance Day, which is a reference to the past wars, and people were sticking the poppies up on the windows as signs. But we were always, anyone who didn't have a balcony was very jealous of those who did, because they would come out every morning and sunbake, and you would look enviously. But for then after that, it just became a routine. For me, it was, you know, I eventually learned that I could actually continue, you know, I'm a runner. I could run from one end of the room to the other end of the room. And I would do that for, you know, an hour and a half almost every day while watching cooking shows. It became almost enjoyable.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. And I mean, I think what's remarkable is that need and ability for that human connection, even if it's stickers on the walls or the windows. I mean, how did it make you feel? Or was it encouraging to be, you know, a part of this group that you're all making a major sacrifice and in a lot of ways for each other? What did that feel like?
Look, again, I totally accepted it. I guess it was something that I knew I was going to have to do if I had got the visa and left the country, and it was part of the price you pay. I guess it was probably something that maybe Americans wouldn't agree with because you don't like giving up your freedoms. There were personal freedoms that you were certainly giving up. But I did think it was for the public good. And you know, after a while, it's actually not that bad. I began to look forward to the knock on the door in the morning with the breakfast after I'd already been up for several hours and had several meetings. And, you know, I began to look forward to the lunches in particular. They were quite good. The dinners were pretty awful, you know, so you got used to that and you got used to the routine. And, you know, I watched lots of television shows, you know, they were very good about giving you little treats, like, you know, there was a lot of sugar in the diet, which is, you know, not something I would normally like, but began to enjoy. So, you know, so after a while, by the end of the 2 weeks, you were almost institutionalized. It was actually hard to go back into the real world again.
Wow. That's really interesting too. And I guess from like a mental health perspective, it's like, you knew it was going to be 2 weeks. So it wasn't like you were, you know, going into this not knowing what amount of time you would be there.
Yeah, and there was a lot of there were a lot of services that were being offered along the way. I mean, there was a mental health check every day. Every around 11 a.m. every morning, you got a phone call from a nurse asking how you were going and whether you're okay. They kept asking you those questions. I mean, you got 2 COVID tests during that period, so obviously, if you were sick, they were clearly prepared to offer those medical services if you needed them. So there was a lot of reassurance there as well. So it wasn't all bad. And you got the impression that it was extremely well organized and extremely well resourced.
And I assume the government was paying for this?
They charge every person, I think it was 3,000 Australian dollars, which is about maybe 2,000 American dollars for the 2 week stay in the hotel. But that's, you know, that's not a lot considering the resources they put into this. So yeah, there's a big burden on the state here. And I mean, the number of people involved the number of police and army officials and nurses and doctors that were involved in keeping us safe. I mean, the hotels, I think, were, you know, almost hermetically sealed from the rest of the world. You weren't allowed out. You weren't allowed in either. So, I mean, friends could come and drop gift baskets off for you, which would be brought to your room. But there were certain rules around alcohol. They were limiting the amount of alcohol you were allowed per day. So it was a little bit paternal and maternal in that regard. But I guess that was to do with your mental health and not, you know, so the people wouldn't just drink 3 bottles of vodka a day to get through it, you know.
And the problems that might present to the other guests, I would guess.
I'm guessing that some people handled it well and probably others didn't. I didn't mind because of the kind of work I do anyway. I spend long hours every day on a computer talking to people and working on a computer. So for me, it was almost like just an extra 2 weeks of my routine. It's just I just had to change some of my habits. I learned very quickly I couldn't make phone calls at 3 in the morning, even though it suited my time zone. It didn't suit the other guests.
Yes. And producing this hour, I am learning that you all in Australia have a lot of late middle of the night meetings because of us selfish people in the Northern Hemisphere. So I'm enlightened about the schedules and the hours that you keep. I'm curious, because you were in Australia, you were in DC in the US, you went through Europe. I mean, what were the differences that you saw in the approaches to COVID as you went through those travels?
The first thing I got was a real shock, because I had, even though I'd come through Hong Kong before the crisis really hit, and it was COVID had hit Hong Kong at the time, and I was quite shocked when I was coming through there to realize that I had to wear a mask, because it was socially unacceptable not to wear a mask. And I thought it was all kind of curious, and almost I was kind of glad to be observing that period of time, but it was a curiosity more than anything. I didn't see it as a danger, and I certainly never felt in any danger. I then went from Hong Kong into Australia. There was, you know, nobody stopped me at the airport. I was able to walk straight through. No one, in there were no health checks at that point. We were still, you know, Australia was still very complacent about the virus. And then for months I was here, and there was no real danger here. I mean, I was in Sydney. You know, the virus was something that was still a kind of a curiosity. The moment I tried to leave the country is when I realized the rest of the world had changed. Getting into DC, which was my first, well, I went in through Dubai first, and I had a few nights there, and to realize that they were disinfecting the gym that I was going to. So I would go to a gym, and I realized that at certain times of the day, the gym was closed because they would literally spray the entire gym with disinfectant. And that was my first kind of realization that the world had changed. And then getting into DC and realizing that everybody in DC was wearing a mask. And that was a shock. And then getting used to wearing a mask every day was a shock. Having, you know, no coffee facilities or restaurant facilities in the hotel was a shock. Having to eat out, take away every day was a shock. But then getting to Europe, I went through Portugal. And again, because the weather was nice, people didn't seem to be too worried about the virus. I was there for a few weeks. By the time I was finished leaving Portugal and going to France, which was my next stop, people were then beginning to, you know, to really get worried about it. And in Paris, the day I arrived, a curfew was called. And, you know, I had intended to travel to several other countries, and I realized that I wasn't going to be able to do that. And the day that I left Paris was when they completely shut the whole country down. And in fact, my aircraft out of Paris back towards Australia was delayed by more than an hour, because they suddenly had a huge rush of people trying to get on the plane to get out of Paris.
I feel like you have this unique perspective that, you know, I haven't really seen anywhere else during this time, other than what we read and write. I guess I'll end with, I mean, then you are back now at home. What was your biggest takeaway on the Australian approach, the way that they've handled traveling, and the effort there to contain the virus? I mean, I think you guys are down to single digit cases in most places, you know, where we're seeing cases surge across the country.
It is like the virus doesn't exist here right now. There are no restrictions. You can go to a restaurant, you can have a meal, you can go out with friends, you can have gatherings. When I walk to the supermarket, I don't walk with a mask, or, you know, it is like it doesn't exist. So I think it's, you know, it's a combination, I suppose, of good management and geography. You're able to do this in a country, but also a willingness. People here are willing to give up certain freedoms to gain this, I guess, and to try and combat the virus. I'm not sure that other countries would have done that. And I'm not sure it would have been possible to do, you know, if you weren't in an island in the middle of nowhere like Australia is. You know, it's hard to compare. It's fantastic. I mean, the weather here is beautiful because it's now summer. You can, you know, it's nice to be able to run without a mask on, to enjoy all the privileges of restaurants and gatherings and everything. But I realize that the world isn't, it really isn't like that. And And there were things we had to give up. I mean, I really resented having to apply for a visa to leave the country, because my, you know, my whole working life is about moving from country to country. I mean, I spend a lot of time in the US, I spend a lot of time in Europe and here, and I'm used to be able to, you know, getting on a plane, going away for 4 weeks, coming back for a while, going away again. You know, I really did resent the loss of freedom. And I was worried that I wouldn't be getting a visa. I realized that I'm one of the privileged few that were allowed to leave the country and come back again. But yeah, I'm not sure everyone would be happy with that situation.
Oh, I mean, I think I, you know, would say for us here, it's so many people are here are trying to convince us that this is all inevitable, that there was no other way. We had to do this. So it's very helpful for us to hear stories of places where you contained it. You're back to normal, and not because you're ignoring the spread of the pandemic, but because you've controlled it. So I think that's very helpful for us to hear.
Yeah, I think you'll probably find if you talk to experts that a lot of it's to do with they really concentrated their efforts on tracing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that, but there's a lot of freedoms that you had to give up. I mean, at one point, we were all encouraged, everybody here was encouraged to download an app that basically is like a spy app on your phone that, you know, and you now, if you want to go into a, you know, a hairdressing salon or wherever, you've got to, you know, enter, you've got to download again with your smartphone an app to get in. And they, you know, the idea being, of course, that if somebody during the period you're there, it's the same with a restaurant. If you do go to a restaurant, you know, they monitor your movements a lot. So the idea being, of course, that if somebody is in there during the period you're there and they have COVID, that they will contact you and that they can trace the spread of the virus if it does spread. And so you are giving up a lot of what I think a lot of people would think are fundamental freedoms. So there's a price to pay here. It's not a, you know, price-free zone. Yeah, some people would not like this. And as a journalist, of course, I don't like being traced. I don't like people knowing where I'm going or who I'm meeting. It's actually quite an important thing for me. So I've now, if I do want to meet somebody, I've got to leave my phone behind.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, those are all interesting things to consider too. But, you know, then you can go see your friends and go out to dinner, which at this point sounds really good to me.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm an investigative reporter and I do a lot of, I mean, I meet a lot of sources around the world. I need my privacy. People now know, like, you know, there are at least four governments that know that I have visited, you know, their countries.
Right.
And I don't like that.
No,
I really don't.
Detrimental. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much again.
No worries. Well, good luck with your program. Thank you
so much. Bye.